You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Auckland Mayor Phil Gough outlined the annual budget for 2020 to 2021 on Tuesday. Most significant is his plan to reduce the council's emissions by 20% by moving to electric vehicles and sustainable energy across various council facilities. Another big part of the budget is preparations for a series of international events to be hosted in Auckland in 2021, including the America's Cup. I sat down with Phil Gough to talk about these parts of the budget in more detail, as well as asking him about the ongoing bus lockout and Jacinda Ardern's decision to move the port.
G'day, Phil. How are you doing, first of all?
I'm doing well, thank you very much. Yeah.
That's great.
Christmas can't come soon enough, but apart from yeah. that, you know what
yeah, exactly. And I feel the same way. So could you give me a quick rundown of some of the policies you proposed in this budget outline?
Yeah, look, there are a range of policies that are important. First of all, this is the third year of our long-term plan, our 10-year budget. And what you see in it is an investment in the 2021 year of $2.7 billion on capital projects, and that's $1 billion more than it was 3 years ago on an annual basis. So a continuation of a big increase in spending on our vitally needed infrastructure, such as transport, infrastructure needed for housing and for the environment. So in summary, what are the big things that we're doing? We're investing in infrastructure so that we can cater for our growing population. We're investing in the environment and starting further investment in tackling the problem of climate change, particularly by reducing the council's own emissions. And we'll do a whole lot more in the next long-term plan, which we'll be negotiating next year. And we're doing things to ensure that we've got plenty of parks, open spaces, and that we are improving our investment in sporting organisations, and we're providing for a more inclusive city by making sure that those people who work for council all get the living wage.
That's great. So it seems like a big emphasis has been placed on preparing Auckland for 2021, where we're hosting a few international events, the most notable of which being the America's Cup. How do events like this impact how you look at an annual budget?
Well, there are three big things that we provided in the current year for expenditure on infrastructure. One was $500 million going into the City Rail Link, which future-proofs it to carry 54,000 people an hour and also puts aside contingency funds to cover any increase in construction costs. The second was the America's Cup, where we're investing $113 million in infrastructure for that, and that will include some major legacy programs that will leave our waterfront a better place for use by Aucklanders in the future for recreation and leisure. And the third, we were forced to invest to keep Eden Park going, $50 million in capital value for the current year. For the America's Cup, the America's Cup is part of a year for Auckland, which is going to be phenomenally vibrant and exciting. We start the year with the Prada Cup for the Challengers, for the America's Cup. We then host Te Matatini, which will be the biggest ever Maori cultural event in New Zealand's history. And then we move on to the America's Cup itself. Following that, we've got World Cups for women's rugby and for women's cricket and for men's softball. We'll have APEC in the leaders' meeting, which involves 10,000 people coming to the city in a week towards the end of the year. And we finish the year by hosting the Ocean Race Cup, which used to be known as the Volvo Around the World Cup. So it's going to be a big year for Auckland. And that will make our city a vibrant and exciting place to live in, but it will also showcase Auckland to the world. And the various events that we're hosting bring in literally hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of additional expenditure, which will be good for our economy and our prosperity in Auckland.
Another thing that you mentioned that I thought was quite huge was that you're extending the living wage to cleaners contracted by the council. What's the rationale behind that?
Well, at the moment, cleaners aren't directly employed by council, but they effectively work for council. The people that come in and clean my office at night when I'm finished, the people that clean our trains and our buses, the people that clean our community facilities and the venues where we hold events, And we believe that we therefore have an obligation to those people, and that they should have a decent wage that they can live on for an honest week's work. So that will end up, I think, in the year of final implementation of that, costing about $3.9 million. But it's fair, because if people are working for the people of Auckland, in a city that's quite expensive in comparison to other parts of the country, they need a wage that enable them to live in the city and to do the work that they do. So having paid all of our staff directly employed by council the living wage by September of this year, we will now go on to the next biggest group, which is our cleaners, which work for contractors but effectively are working for council. And that's about fairness and about decency, about making sure that those people that, you know, often do pretty tough jobs that many of us wouldn't want to do and don't get paid much for it, can have a wage that they can now live on and support their family and give their family the chance to participate like everybody else in our community.
That's great. That's really great. You also mentioned a need for Auckland to lead by example on climate change. How much of an impact do you think Auckland's actions can have on New Zealand at large?
Well, you know, in the overall scheme of things, what we do and what New Zealand does doesn't impact massively on overall global climate warming. What happens in big countries like the United States and China and India do matter, but we can't preach to other countries what they ought to be doing unless we walk the talk ourselves. And our attitude in Auckland is, as a council organisation, if we're saying to other commercial corporates across Auckland that they should consider replacing their carbon fuel-driven fleet with an electric fleet, what better way to have strong persuasive power than to lead by example? And if we convert our fleet to electric from diesel and petrol, and the rest of the corporate fleet do the same, then we create a market for second-hand electric cars for those who can't afford to buy new a couple of years down the track. And we know that 46% of the carbon emissions created in our city are from our transport, people driving cars on the road in particular. So what we're saying is we are committed as a council to reducing our carbon emissions by the actions that we take and the budget we adopt in the coming year to cut our carbon emissions by 20%. And that's just the start. You know, we'll be doing a lot more after that, but it is leading by example, and it is saying this is the right thing for us to do, and it's the right thing for the rest of the country and the rest of the world to do if we are to stop the catastrophe that global heating will provide for our children and our grandchildren's generations.
How important is public transport in combating the climate crisis?
Well, it's really important, because we know that the way to cut out a high percentage of our carbon emissions in Auckland, 46% of them come from our vehicle fleet right across the city, private cars and corporate and public sector cars. We need to make a big impression on that. So you take a standard bus that will carry 90 people travelling on a bus, even if it is a diesel bus still in the short term, that's going to burn far less carbon than 90 people driving their own cars in single occupancy cars into work and back from work each day. It both cuts down on traffic congestion, but it also cuts down on our carbon emissions. When we produce a decent public transport system and we produce decent walkways and cycleways that link up, we can significantly reduce our carbon footprint. But what we're also doing is, in the planning provisions that we're making for the city, we are enabling people to live in more intensive housing, terrace housing and apartment dwellings, around those arterial public transport routes. And that also cuts down the carbon footprint for the city. So it's those sort of things that longer term will have a major impact on ensuring that our city can meet the goals that we've set for ourselves and the world has asked us to set, which is to keep our global warming at or below 1.5% centigrade.
So, staying on the topic of public transport, are you willing to share your feelings on the NZ bus lockout that's going on at the moment?
Well, it's obviously a really unfortunate position to have got to. where the inability of New Zealand Bus and the unions that they're negotiating a collective agreement with to settle their dispute without involving interruption of the provision of buses to our commuters. We have set out with central government through the Ministry of Transport, local governments across the country, bus companies across the country, and workers' unions across the country, a memorandum of understanding that is focused on improving bus drivers' working conditions and wages. I've got a lot of personal sympathy for bus drivers. Big responsibility to be driving a vehicle of that size, and pretty hard when the pay is pretty low and when the working conditions mean that you have split shifts so that you can be working a very long day with a period that you're not paid to work in between. And we know we have to address that, that the government and council need to make more funds available, and we need to ensure that we can recruit and retain our professional bus driving staff when we're increasing that mode of our transport. That is different from being involved in the negotiation of the collective agreement. We are looking at the longer term and the wider implications of needing to improve conditions and wages, but we don't get directly involved. We're not the conciliators, the mediators, or the arbitrators of this transport dispute. That's got to be resolved between the unions and the employers. But what we have said, outside that sort of direct negotiation, we will work with everybody to make sure that we can produce a situation where we're paying our drivers adequately, we're giving them reasonable working conditions, and we're addressing the shortfall of bus drivers because it's so hard to retain and recruit drivers on current conditions and wages. That's important.
So just to finish off and just moving away from the budget a bit, while I've got you, I wanted to ask for your thoughts on the Prime Minister's decision to move the port out of Auckland.
Well, the Prime Minister hasn't changed her position, and that position is the same as what most of us on council have always believed, that the port will have to move. In the Ports Future Study that council commissioned, we said that would probably be around about a 30-year period, because at that point we would outgrow the port would outgrow its footprint, and we would have to look for a new place for the port. That's within a time frame of probably between 20 and 40 years. Secondly, I'm quite keen that the port ultimately and progressively moves to free up more space on the waterfront for public access and for other uses. What the Prime Minister has been careful not to do is to endorse a movement to a particular location, Northport. And I've got to say, as the person that long before the government was elected, I called for a report that would say, where should Auckland's port move to that would be in the best interests of our city, our region and our country? I called for a report and I said that that report needed to be robust, it needed to be evidence-driven, and it needed to be independent. Sadly, the report that has been dished up is neither robust, evidence-driven, nor independent. And I regret that, because no government and no council are going to be involved with spending $10 billion with the huge opportunity costs of what that means and not being able to do other major infrastructure projects for housing, for transport, for the environment, social infrastructure, unless a proper case is made out. What the government has now decided to do is to examine what the findings of this independent working group, so-called independent working group, have come up with, and cast a treasury eye and hopefully some other independent economic analytical work over what's been proposed, because it seems to me that the working group has developed a conclusion and then set out to find evidence to back up that conclusion. That's not the right way to do it, to protect our interests as a city and as members of this country.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.